who don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 339, and we're driving all the time. It's your host, Ify Whitey Wayne, in the booth with me, all my friends. So let me introduce you to Dams. First up, we have esteemed critic and Christmas zaddy, none other than Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Well, I'll tell you, Ify, since I am a white gay man over the age of 40, I am legally required to be watching Feud, Capote versus the Swans, which I am, and I'm enjoying it. And this past episode featured an appearance by author James Baldwin. And I thought, I need to read more James Baldwin. Giovanni's Room, one of my favorite books of all time, a big fan of Go Tell It on the Mountain. And then I realized I had not read a lot of his nonfiction, even though I loved I Am Not Your Negro, which is almost entirely based on basically a pitch he wrote for a book he never finished about various assassinated civil rights leaders. So I picked up a copy of The Fire Next Time. And you know that thing where you read something that was written 60 years ago and it's still like totally relevant to the current situation in the United States? This is that thing.
In a bummer way?
Yeah, in a bummer way. But the prose
never
is,
in a good way.
Is electric, you know? And so, yeah, as much as you're being like, oh, man, but man, the way he talks about this stuff, the way that he is kind of just sort of laying out what Black life in America as he has experienced has been like, and what the choices were and what the dead ends were and what the, you know, how the entire system is shaped in such a way to make people fail. It just leaps off the page. And so if you have never read any Baldwin, or if you've only read the fiction, I highly recommend this one. But really, pretty much any James Baldwin you can get your hands on, you won't go wrong.
I had forgotten that he... ironically, in a twist of what you're saying, that he did Giovanni's Room, because I think of him in such a nonfiction capacity, having watched the documentary recently, or revisited his like appearances on DeKavit and stuff. Like, oh my God, yeah, he does it all.
He did write If Beale Street Could Talk.
I mean, I did remember that because, you know, it was a major motion picture. And apparently that's what it needs to click in my brain.
Believe me, that is my brain,
yes,
too.
What a brain.
Oh, man. Well, you know who else has a good brain, has a great noggin, knows how to chill on a pontoon, knows how to select, films to be programmed in a film fest, knows how to select films to be picked for an award show. It's none other than the Queen of the Midwest herself, super producer Drea Clark. What's good?
The list of attributes that you connect to me are has cats, enjoys pontoons, does stuff with movies. Honestly, none of them wrong, and also how my parents would probably describe it. So, very appropriate. What's good with me? Hey, it's voting season again. We are a week away from the March 5th official deadline, the day that we're recording this anyway. And I got my ballot off into the mail. Well, I didn't do a mail. I did a ballot drop box because there's one in Koreatown that I'm good friends with, and I always like to visit it when I can. And it meant a lot. And once again, there's several. If you're in the Los Angeles area, there's great progressive voter guides that I like to use.
Yes.
Because I know it's really intimidating in these down market elections, as I call them. Probably no one in the
who are these judges?
Who are these people? Why do I care? Like, I don't have children, but I like to get my vote in on the education, the school board, all of that stuff. Anyway, check out your local guidelines. You can find people who are doing the heavy lifting, and we'll break it down for you. But honestly, for these are the elections where a very small amount of votes can make a difference.
So
I'll be that person. I'll talk about my love of pontoons and my love of my Dropbox ballot all in one go. That's my truth.
I did my Dropbox ballot and got my text from the state of California telling me that my ballot was received and counted, which I love. Takes the guesswork out because, you know, it's many a slip, etc. But yeah, I've taken it down to the WeHo City Hall. There's a box there. And then a couple days later, getting that text, letting me know it's all done. And then I don't have to think about it again. It's lovely.
Yeah. See you in hell, ballot.
Well, we're not going to see them in hell. We'll see them in the gym. It's comedian and co-host of the podcast, Y'all Gay, Ever Maynard. What's good?
Woo! Oh, my God. Thank you for having me. Oh, my God. Iffy, I was just thinking about you because after this podcast, I'm going to the gym and the goal is to hit a new PR and bench. So that's what's good. I haven't done bench. Y'all are talking about such like educated things and I'm like, I'm a meathead, I love lifting.
Here's how dumb I am. Is that a personal record?
You nailed it.
Yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah.
It's like the what is it, Muriel Hemingway film?
Personal best. Yes.
Personal
PR,
best.
Very similar.
Because I was thinking I would go to the gym if I could hit a public relations person, but that isn't offered at any of the ones that I know.
They are there.
They are definitely there.
That's true. I could ask one, maybe.
No, I love my PR witnesses. I would love to witness. No, I haven't bench pressed in 3 years. I always do other machines. And I laid down the other day, and I said, I can actually do a lot. So today I want to hit 125.
No, dang.
That's my goal today. I'm very, very close.
We're rooting for you.
That's a good number. I know. And we still need to get our lift in together. We still need to get our lift.
We have to lift.
Yeah, I'll text you after the pod and we'll connect. We'll make it happen. We always end up on shows together and we're like, we got to get to the gym. We got to get. And then we're squeezing each other's arms and everyone's like, what is up with those?
It's like, no homo, man. I'm also gay, just so everybody knows. but it's nice.
It's in the title of the podcast.
I do like the idea of you hosting a podcast called Y'all Gay if you weren't.
Yeah.
Hey, quick question. Y'all gay? What's going on here?
It's really a witch hunt.
Someone else has fallen into my trap.
Yeah.
Iffy, what's good with you?
Oh, what's good with me? Well, you know, it was my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
Pisces baby.
Yeah, you know, very emotional, very, very good. The first episode of Actually is out right now as of recording, as with me as the host. Lots of good stuff this week, but I think the biggest news ever is that Naomi had to do a diorama for school, and Em really kind of, it was very funny because before the school year, Em was saying like, it'll be like fun to do like a diorama or something. And then, because with me, I don't think I had a diorama assignment my whole like school like career, and then like next thing you know, Aurora was like, "Hey, yeah, Naomi has to do a diorama," and I was like, "Don't worry, I got a guy. I sleep with him every night."
So I blame Wes Anderson for bringing the diorama back into the public school conversation.
Yeah.
My friends, my grown-ass friends, had a diorama club for a minute.
Ooh.
Which honestly, I say that out loud. We should maybe revisit. But like, we would have different themes and you would craft like a shoebox-sized diorama and bring it and then enjoy each other's handiwork over cocktails and nonsense.
That's so dope.
I bet M could be a nice diorama.
Oh yeah, I'll pitch it to her. I feel like she'd be down for it. I mean, I can't roast any diorama clubs because I sit and paint tiny figures.
Yeah,
you know,
fair.
Me and Stuart Wellington, you know, that's going to be like, if I die, it's going to be a ghost moment where somebody goes behind Stuart and guides his hand as he paints a little tiny space marine.
I did refer to y'all as the beefy Warhammer twins since y'all share a birthday.
We are like minutes into an episode with Ever, and Alonzo's just dropped more y'alls than I've heard from him in 6 months.
Well, don't worry.
I got a lot of y'alls influence.
Questions, especially about this movie. So I am buckled up and ready. So speaking of this movie, we're on the run with Drive Away Dolls. Then we'll have a hotline question about movie litmus tests. But first, it's time for ITIDIC, the acronym that stands for Is This Important? Do I Care? Where we look at the week's movie news and answer that very question. Why don't you kick this off, Alonzo? Because I'm going to just, as soon as you finish saying it, I'm starting to roast.
Okay, yeah. So if you thought the craziest thing out of Tyler Perry last week was his new Netflix movie, Mea Culpa, in a recent interview with The Hollywood Reporter, the movie mogul and filmmaker behind movies like Madea Goes to Jail says he was both impressed and alarmed by a recent demo of the new Sora AI video generating program. As an artist, Perry expressed serious concerns for the future of his industry, calling for regulation of the technology. As an actor, he appreciated the way AI allows him to spend less time in the makeup chair for recent projects. And as a businessman, he has put a pause on the $800 million expansion of his Tyler Perry Studios in Atlanta, which would have added 12 new sound stages to the backlot. Is this important? Do you care?
I say yes. I say yes for multiple reasons. Ooh. I'm going to say, yeah, one, it does sound right off the bat. It sounds like a product placement for Sora. But if you take it down on another level, like that's taking jobs away from carpenters, electricians, plumbers. So if you look at it at like a working class kind of scale or even a different union scale besides like someone who owns a studio. Yeah, it's fucked up.
He's legendarily not paid writers for a long time. So I've heard the idea of like more people to not pay.
I didn't know that.
Tyler Perry, this is his whole bag. So it wasn't surprising when all that news came out. I almost feel like he was waiting for a way to back out of this studio expansion.
Piece of shit.
Yeah. He is. I like to look at Tyler Perry as like the Kanye West of movies, and not necessarily more recently, but definitely before all the like terrible stuff, but very much like you should just stop talking and I feel like you would do better. But honestly, I think that'd make him worse in that regard because he's not doing good to begin with. At least, you know, Kanye was making good music.
This man is a bad man. He's a bad man.
And with AI, he can do bad all by himself.
Thank you. Bingo. We did it. Nailed
You're going to sleep so well. I haven't gotten that out there.
That one tickled me.
I will add that in addition to the writer's things, he's known for, he'll shoot entire features in an incredibly condensed amount of time. He does everything on his sound stages so that people have to work like extraordinary hours for flat rates, just all sorts of sketchy things. But I'll say the most sophisticated writing or elegant phrasing he's ever had is in this interview, because he puts it off to like a larger, like, oh, the government should regulate this because
not me, I'm gonna use it.
He's like, because he acknowledges that it's going to mess with the artists, the artisans, the craftspeople, all of those people are going to take a hit. But he does not do the, oh, I own this and I'm a billionaire, so I'm going to step up and set a precedent of what it could look like to still honor what these people are doing. He's like, oh, I don't need sets anymore, so those people will lose their jobs. And I feel terrible about it. So when's somebody going to do something about all these problems is really what I'm getting there.
If only someone with power in their own studio would step up.
And I do think it's an area that will need increasing regulation, because the other part of it is if you're bidding on things and other people's production budget reflects, oh, we're not doing any location shoots, we're augmenting with AI for those, so we're going to have a 12 like dollar line item where you have a $2 billion one. Like, those things do need, you have to have them regulated. But for him to just put it all out there as if he had no say in the fix of it.
He's already used AI in two films. Sorry, I just got upset. I just started reading this interview. He's already used AI.
Yeah.
Oh, I believe it.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I have learned something in the first 30 seconds of this conversation, and I'm angry.
Yeah.
This is important and you do care.
This will be helping me get my PR today.
Yes.
Fuel you. Well, I'll move us along to our next itadic item. Speaking of movies, we've told you in the past years about the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, which has been tracking representation in Hollywood since 2007. This year, the news, not so good. Unlike you hear the word news and you normally think good. What a twist. 2023 saw a steep drop in the percentage of films with a female lead, down from 2022's record high of 44%. The study tracks the 100 highest grossing films in any year. In 2023, only three films featured female leads or co-leads over the age of 45. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, obviously, yes. And the question then, of course, becomes like, how do we keep winding up here? I mean, the highest grossing film of last year, to remind everybody, was Barbie. And every time a hit like that happens, the conversation is never about, well, how do we center more women in front of the camera and behind the camera? But it's like, what if we make a Polly Pocket movie? Like it's never, it's always a fluke unless it is what generations of Hollywood has decided is the way that you make movies, which is white dudes all the time.
And when you dig into it, it's so interesting that the smaller the indie segment, you get your like A24s and roadside attractions, those are still like above average. It's like 53% are female led. And then Disney is close. I think it's like 46% because you have your lot of like for young girls, like princess. Yeah. I don't know what princess things they're doing these days. I'm behind on the princess beat, but it's
female
that
animated
whole other,
lead. So yeah,
it's the talking point of, oh, the quadrant we care about is young men. And that's pervasive in so many studios and what they give money to, what projects they get behind. And it makes me vomitous.
It does, and it gets me mad for many other reasons too, because I think it kind of like even subverts this idea, right, that these people care about the bottom dollar. No, I think these people care about making sure that white men are front and center. Like it's clear. It's clear as day, because anytime things that do actually make money that don't put them at the center, it gets cast aside and they will take that L rather than like, try and open themselves to it. Like I was listening to the journal. It's their like podcast. They were talking about that Stanley Cup craze. And basically the reason why, and it's been getting credited to this like marketer guy who came from Crocs. It was not his fucking idea. It had nothing to do with him at all. What it was it was these Utah moms that were like consumer guides, and they were like, hey, we're trying to get hydrated. Y'all should get these Stanley Cups. And they sold out and they only had black and white. So they were
begging.
I
only clocked you were talking about those cups. I was like, did we switch to hockey so fast?
No. Yes. The one that Ever just put on in front of their screen. Yeah. Which, you know, I am proud that y'all thought of the NHL Stanley Cup as a hockey guy in a Kings hoodie myself. But no, I was talking about the Stanley Cup trend that's been blowing up. And it was these moms, who were doing these consumer guys, and they were like, they're selling out very quickly, but you only have black and white. You need more colors. And they were doing like bulk orders themselves, making hand over fist money, selling these cups to Stanley. And they were like, well, no, it's not what we want. And it was this Croc guy who came and finally listened and was like, oh, well, like based on everything they're saying, we should do more colors. And then it blew up. So really the Croc guy was the guy who finally just listened. But the impetus behind it was women and trying to cater to it. But you had this company, Stanley, that's a construction brand, that was like, no, we'd rather center on men than make tons of money. And I tell that whole story to say that this is at the core of, I think, every capitalistic issue. Instead of looking at like, oh, you know, women are interested in this, we should lean into female-led movies, we should lean into female directors, they're like, no, let's just make more stuff about these girly things. That's surely what it was.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, like I said, Barbie, biggest hit of last year, both the seventh Mission Impossible movie and the fifth Indiana Jones movie were considered disappointments for what they cost. And it's like, reverse those things and it would be like, well, we can't do any more of these women movies because they're clearly tanking. But when it's like, you know, when you've got established movie stars and established franchises who are not earning what it costs to make these movies, there's always a reason, there's always an excuse, there's always a way to write it off. And the Barbie becomes just one in a series of flukes, you know.
When we should be getting Assault 2. And by Salt, I do mean S-A-L-T, Angelina Jolie,
yes,
action,
yes,
franchise.
Yes.
Let's do 1,000 of those.
So let me jump in and talk about the Spirit Awards that were last Sunday. Some would say the only award show that matters. Film Independent held its annual Spirit Awards this past Sunday. The ceremony was hosted by Aidy Bryant and saw major awards go to Past Lives and its director, Celine Song, American Fiction star Jeffrey Wright and screenwriter-director Cord Jefferson, and the holdover supporting cast members Davine Joy Randolph and Dominic Sessa. Our own Drea Clark was there, probably getting thanked from the stage again, so we don't even really need to ask. But I will, because that's the name of the segment. Is this important? Do you care?
Very important. I was there with my buddy Alonzo Duralde.
That's right. A table over.
Kang was there. All sorts of people who've been on here were there. Alonzo was there in a full-on Fred Rogers cardigan, so you know it was popping. Yes. Yeah, it was great. Well, it was complicated. How's that?
Yeah, it was. This is the year, as you probably have read in the media, that a gentleman with a bullhorn stationed himself outside with a recorded loop, protesting the situation in Gaza. And unlike other award shows that take place behind walls made of brick or stone or glass, when you're in a tent, you can pretty much hear everything. And that loudspeaker was enough to like rattle people on stage. And I think, but everybody carried on and got through with it. But it was, I was kind of amazed, A, that no one had ever done that before, and that B, there didn't seem to be any thing in place to make that not happen. But, you know, I imagine in future years it will, you know, be a thing.
Yeah, I'll say an additional fun fact. One of the people leading that is actually a Spirit Award winner from 3 years ago, Marawi Jarima. His film Residue won our Cassavetes Award, and he was the one with the bullhorn. So the irony, it was definitely someone who understands, like, we have a tent full of people who are activists in many parts of their lives, and a lot of them as artists. One of the things that made it especially complicated, other than the noise started up sort of halfway through, you couldn't really hear what it was for the first 10, 15 minutes. So the first whole batch of presenters and winners, there was a sense it was just general heckling, like someone who was like, oh, I'm going to mess with this Hollywood thing. And so people were making kind of like glib jokes to try and sort of move it along. And I'm sure after the fact we're like, anyway, so there was a unintentional flippantness that came with that. As ever, I'm proud of our nominees and our winners, and I hope people check them out. It was very real, just complication of being there and wanting to celebrate. And, you know, so many of the people that are being recognized in our show, nobody's heard of. Like, yes, Natalie Portman was there, but also, did you know Kauthar Ben-Hanaya, the director of Four Daughters? No, you don't. Like, there's all these people that were there being recognized who were then having to kind of balance their reactions in this moment when they don't often get it. So, I don't know that everything went as well as anybody would have wanted, but I also, I think it was better letting people just kind of say and do what they needed rather than us trying to steer the reaction from like a Film Independent voice. Yeah,
it was very Film Independent, I think, in how it played out. And I will say, just on the level of the nominees and what won this year, I mean, a lot of really great choices. Celine Song won Best Director. As I said, yes, the white gay male vote in the director category split down all the parts, because her competition was literally Todd Haynes, Iris Sachs, Andrew Haig, and William Oldroyd. American Fiction got honored, and The Holdovers. And, you know, it's always cool that the Spirits will include films that haven't even opened yet, but that have premiered at film festivals and already sort of begun their kind of march towards people knowing about them. Like, one of the major nominees over the weekend was this film called We Grown Now, which Sony Classics is going to open in April. Wow. And I imagine we will probably wind up talking about on this show, but it was the first time I'd heard of it.
Yep. And I'll also add, I got to stand within 15 feet simultaneously of Marshawn Lynch and Andrew Scott and Rachel Sennett. So,
nice.
Wow.
I'm just going to sleep through all of next weekend. I also got to dance sort of near Andrew Scott, which, like, I didn't realize was a life goal, but whew, wheel me out.
Is that why I didn't get a ticket, Dre? Because you knew Rachel Sennett was going to be there, and you were like, I don't want to see this happen.
Because I was there with your friend that you had never told me about.
I know. I gripped his neck so hard. I'll tell you that much.
How come I wasn't invited?
Oh, yeah.
Ever, next time.
Yeah. Yeah, let's come on, Deborah. Yeah, let's come get on, it. Let's get, down to brass tacks. As a matter of fact, we're going to get so deep into it, but we're going to take a break so y'all don't have to listen to it. But when we come back, we're talking about Driveaway Dolls.
I'm Emily Fleming.
And I'm Jordan Morris.
We're real comedy writers.
And real friends.
And real fucking cheapskates.
We say, why subscribe to expensive streaming services when you can stream tons of insane movies online for free?
As long as you're fine with 25 randomly inserted super loud car insurance commercials.
On our new podcast, Free With Ads, we review streaming movies from the darkest corner of the internet's bargain bin.
From the good to the weird to the holy shit, look at Jean-Claude Van Damme's big old butt.
Free With Ads, a free podcast about free movies that's worth the price of admission.
Every Tuesday on MaximumFun.org or your favorite pod spot.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm Yosef Uwadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Ever Maynard.
Alonzo Duraldi.
Today's film comes from us from just one of the Coen brothers, Ethan Coen, in his feature debut as a solo director. It stars Geraldine Viswanathan and Margaret Qualley and was written by Coen and Trisha Cook, who is also Coen's wife. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Driveaway Dolls?
Sure. Qualley and Viswanathan are lesbian best friends in 1999 Philadelphia, and Qualley's character is sort of a libertine. She has a very free and open sex life, whereas Viswanathan is very buttoned down and wears those like frilly blouses with the bow at the collar, you know. And they decide they both want a change in their lives, so they head to Tallahassee, Florida, as one does. And they go to one of those drive-away services where they're going to deliver the car to their destination city. But oops, wouldn't you know it, they are accidentally given a car with the briefcase in the trunk the mob is trying to deliver. And so naturally, of course, bad guys are in pursuit, chasing them through queer dive bars and soccer team makeout parties. And, you know, will they make it to Florida in one piece? Driveaway Dolls.
Ooh.
Can I interject something just at the top here? Because I find it fascinating. I do think it's a good umbrella point.
Yeah.
That Trisha Cook, who's the co-collaborator in this, is a longtime Coen Brothers editor and co-wrote this, and it's inspired by her life. She's a queer woman, and she and Ethan have a very like untraditional marriage, and that they both have other partners. She's been with another woman for a long time, and I just like to lay that foundation, because I know when you look at this, and obviously on a studio side, giving the world another Coen film, like, oh, from the minds that gave you Fargo, like, that's going to be the selling thing. I wish she had a co-director credit on this, but I do think it's important just for our conversations, because this film is trying to and marries a lot of what you know of the Coen brothers, kind of, you know, we give absurdity and black comedy and there's crime and absolute insanity, like bigger than life characters and these absurdist moments and all of that. And then you're doing it through this very intentional queer lens and life experience and these girls who are sort of falling for each other, and also just one of them's trying to get the other one laid. Like, there's all sorts of things happening. Just wanted to put that out there because I think it's
I appreciate
relevant.
That. Because I was written by Ethan and Trisha, you know, Coen Cook. At first I was like, a heterosexual couple.
Truly.
And then when I read Trisha Cook, I was like, okay, read her little biography over here on Wikipedia. Then I was on board. Because as a dyke, as a butch dyke, specifically, I present very masculine. I identify as non-binary. Something that I get really upset with and something that I'm trying to change is lesbian or positive butch representation. So when I first saw this and I was like, a heterosexual woman is writing about lesbians, you know, like I got my feathers in a ruffle. But then I saw she was queer and I said, okay, but anything that's positive queer cinema, I'm always down to clown with.
Yeah, I know. And I think it is that wonderful thing of, like, you know, highlighting. And once again, you know, the net likes to, argue about this a lot. But, like, being, queer people in, like, you know, heteronormative relationships, it doesn't erase their queerness. And even a bonus, if you're living alternative lifestyles like E&M, poly, and you do get to have that side of yourself exploring at the same time. All of these are great. And I think that's a great point, which is going to, like, tap into, you know, some later stuff that we'll talk about when talking about this movie, because, you know, I definitely felt the queerness, but I also felt the whiteness as well. Overall, this movie was great, but there is one question that I knew after watching this that I had to start this off with, because on this pod, not only do we have a pod not hosted by three straight white dudes, but we also have a native Texan here. Are you a native Texan, right, Alonzo?
Yeah, no. I am too.
Oh, good. Okay. We do have okay, one then, because I moved one there after Texan. College, so
okay.
I can't so
okay. Well, you know, I
do have thoughts about Margaret Qualley's Fort Worth accent. If that's what we're talking about.
Please, Texans. I'm gonna let y'all talk, because I yes.
Her Fort Worth accent via Benoit Blanc from Knives Out.
Usually I spend most of my Texas time in Austin, and then I've been in Dallas sometimes, but I haven't been, like, in deep, because, you know, that's the funny thing about, like, places like Louisiana, right? Like, if you go to, like, New Orleans, it is more of a tone down, but once you start going into the bayou, it's like, whoa, this sounds like a cartoon. It's like, nah, that's just how they sound.
And we know your ear for accents is legendary, as you've demonstrated time and again on this program.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I was very curious, did we feel like it was actually touching on a Fort Worth accent, or did it feel like it was a played up?
I'll want to hear whatever has to say about this, because I haven't lived there in a while.
I feel a little bit embarrassed. I haven't seen it. Is that bad?
I haven't seen the movie.
I haven't seen the movie. I didn't know I was supposed to watch it, and
I guess maybe we weren't specific enough in the invitation to the show.
Oh my god, that's so funny!
Okay. Well,
we're gonna have some spoilers after.
I'm already reading the Wikipedia, and I was like, I think I was supposed to do homework for this.
Yeah. I love it so much.
It was my fault. It was my fault. Oh my god.
Twist. Okay. This is the first time in 300 plus episodes it's come up. I think it's kind of funny, and we just sort of roll with it.
So now we'll talk about things related to the movie, and you can chime in on your thoughts.
I might have misunderstood the email.
So we will be spoiling it for you, as we will be spoiling it for the listeners.
Whoopsie.
I'll jump into the accent side of it, should you hear them. To me, my read on it, as soon as she started, and it's not just the accent, it's also that it's tied in with all these, like, mannerisms, like, listen, sweetheart, little darling, honey pot, like,
sugar
there's
pie.
All these things in the sugar pie. There's all these things in there that, to me, reminded me so viscerally of my reaction to watching Fargo for the first time as a person from Minnesota and being like, nobody talks like that.
That's,
like,
yes.
Right? Like, there's a component for it, but, like, nobody talk. It's so exaggerated.
That's fair.
And to me, that was a lot of. I was like, oh,
yeah. In my least favorite phrase that I've used many times on here as an actor, I always clock that as, like, whenever you have to do an accent, there's, like, anchor phrases that you usually say over it. Like, the classic one is, like, lots of times when people do a Jamaican accent, they'll do unda da si, and then they'll go into whatever they say. And I feel like. Acting trick that was like, oh, if I add this as, like, one of their, like, you know, catchphrases, it'll keep me in it. But I think, like many of us, it was like, oh, this makes it feel like this does not.
I thought maybe it was an homage to her mother's New Orleans accent in Sex, Lies, and Videotape. You know, she's the daughter of Annie McDowell.
Very low-key homage. I like that.
But, yeah, it was a little nutty. But it's not even on the top 10 list of things that bothered me most in this movie.
Right, but I it's interesting, because I wonder if that top 10 list are things that I appreciated, because I certainly It finished. I saw it with Jen, obviously, Jen Wilson, and we had similar reactions-ish, but they were largely, I love the Coen brothers films. I love their absurdist style and what they're doing. And I was like, oh man, I just really dig seeing women and young women get to dive into the kind of absurdist characters that populate Coen brothers films all the time. Like, sure, you get Marge, son of a Gunderson, played by old Franny in
McD
in Fargo, right? But to see, like, to me, Margaret Qualley was playing a John Goodman character, right? Like, blustery nonsense. She was playing, like, if John Goodman was Shane from The L Word,
no,
talking like Benoit Blanc from Knives Out.
No.
Like, it was all, like, this bigger-than-life, absurdist. And by Shane from The... Thank you. I love that you're like, I know what that's shorthand for. But it's that idea of, like, oh, sure, she's, like, the overly confident...
So she's fucking everyone with a bad accent?
Yeah.
Oh my god. I can't wait to watch this.
Yeah. But then I also like Beanie Feldstein plays a fucking cop who's like yelling about her wall dildo. Like, those were such Coen brothers moments through a different lens, and I very much like the juxtaposition.
All right, let me sort of lay this out, because there was a couple things that just like I couldn't get over in this movie. First of all, this movie thinks dildos are funnier than they are, and that audiences will be like ooh, about them, and I don't know that that's really still the case. I do appreciate that Trisha Cook is queer identified. Mm-hmm. I do question the idea, and admittedly, have I ever attended a lesbian makeout party? I have not. I want to. That's my. Let me be very clear about that going in. Do I believe that they take place in well lit living rooms?
No.
With all the action taking place above the shoulder and people switching partners between Linda Ronstadt songs? I don't buy that.
That was much more of a junior high vibe, and these were grown women.
Totally felt like this is what. This is what when you're too old for Judy Blume, this is the next step. And then finally, like, I love the idea of like let's do a crazy Coen brothers movie, but make it, you know, women centric. But this movie really made me appreciate why Coen brothers movies work and how hard it is to make them work, because the timing is so essential. And so I'm kind of shocked that one of the creators here is also an editor, because the timing of the comedy, of the dialogue, of the shot intershot sort of things of how this is supposed to go, it just sucks the air right out. Like, I was watching these scenes and thinking like, okay, this is kind of a funny premise, and oh, that line's kind of funny, but like it doesn't, you have to have that certain rat-a-tat-tat that makes a movie like Fargo or Raising Arizona, one of their sort of deadpan minimalist absurdism movies work. And whatever that magic is not here. Like, I just watched Moonstruck again for Breakfast All Day Patreon. And like that last kitchen scene in the movie is such a masterpiece of like awkward silences and like timing, and this movie's timing is off from the get-go, and it lasts throughout. And I was just kind of shocked, because I love those two actresses. I think, you know, obviously the Coens together have, you know, this is super their wheelhouse, but this movie just never came to life for me.
I didn't have any of that timing problem. I did have an issue. There's an ongoing interstitial bit with like lava lamp imagery.
Oh, right. Psychedelia.
Yeah. And that part, I was like, I don't care. Why am I here? What? Why? Go back to the girls. What am I watching this stuff for?
To me, like watching this movie, it felt like I was like, oh, I know which Coen brother took the lead on The Big Lebowski and Burned After Reading, because it kind of follows that formula, right? Of like, which, and then kind of veers away from it in the end, which I'm like, oh, well, that's, you did the formula and then left, which is a bunch of things happen, but in the end, it kind of like resets and nothing really mattered. But in the end, they kind of like get to like win. And I was like, well, the funny charm about this is having these events all happen and then it just blows up at the end and then you're back at square one, but you're just like, all right, because at the end, the friendship was the key the whole time type deal. And I know this movie was very interesting in a lot of ways. I was watching this and I felt like, I was like, oh, this is, and I'm not trying to like compare like queer movies, but it is that thing, right, where you have the similar themes and they come out at the same times, where it's like, oh, this kind of has like a Bottom-esque energy to it.
Oh, this wishes. This wishes that it was like Bottoms. Like, you know, coming off of Bottoms, I think all of our expectations of what this kind of movie can and should be, frankly, this feels like decades late and a dollar short.
Yeah.
Coming off of Bottoms. Like,
because, you know, it is like the thing, right, where you're like, oh, these are friends and they're not it, and they're friends and they're very different, which is why they're not going to end up together, even though they are gay. And then this movie is like, no, they're going to end up together. One actually was in love with them the whole time. I think I will get the hottest buttered popcorn and pour it into my eyes if I ever have to watch a white person explain to a brown person how to deal with the police ever in my life again. Like, I get like the idea, but I think there was there's an element where you write, you know, these archetypes of characters and you're like, well, this character would tell this character that because of that. But it's like, but there are some things that are just inherently true for brown people that a brown person would not need to know to kind of be on their P's and Q's in Florida with a cop, and they wouldn't need their white friend to explain to them not to talk back to the cops. Like, with that whole sequence made me want to rip my skin off my face.
Felt as if she was just written with no race in mind.
Exactly. Because in the weirdest way, I got excited when the cops showed up, because I was like, oh, they're gonna like touch on like being brown in this place, because they've always focused on being queer in this place, but you have a friend that's brown who's coming to this place, and then that happens, and I was like, oh, you kind of fumbled it.
I agree with you. I think they were just like, we're not going to pretend to handle the nuances of intersectionality, so we're going to skip it entirely. I thought it was a smart choice that it's introduced as like they're on the precipice of Y2K, because it also eliminates cell phones. Because this is a classic. There are so many films in history that you go back and you're like, man, and if cell phones had not existed, then there would be no need for this story.
This
right?
is over this 5 minutes.
It's nothing but, oh, if we could have a quick conversation, it would eliminate all of that.
It also serves to let Beanie Feldstein's cop smuggle a gun onto a plane.
Yeah, that's true. Because we're pre-2001. Yeah. One of the things in here that Marissa took note of, which I enjoyed in it, I very much liked Beanie Feldstein in this. I wish she played more just sort of angry. She's like this feral ex-girlfriend, very recent ex, and like vindictive. I just like it. I like seeing people get to be angry who normally have to be cute or whatever. And she's obviously, it's like intentionally queer because she plays the ex-girlfriend, but some of the supporting cast, like you have Coleman Domingo's the lead baddie that we see,
right?
And one of his henchmen is Joey Slotnick, and I really appreciated the casting of that. Of if I had gotten just the exact same lift from Coens of who was populating this world. Joey Slotnick, I also was like, yeah, make that guy a passive aggressive henchman and all sorts of things. Well, that was terrific.
But like, they, you know, he's funny. He's trying to really sort of like, you know, do this, but like, you can so tell that he and CJ Wilson have been written to be the Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare of this movie.
Yeah.
And if the material were better and the timing were sharper, they could be, because I think those guys have it in them. But that just to me felt like this sort of emblematic of all the things that weren't landing in this film, the way that their repartee just didn't have that same zing.
Whereas I read it of like, oh, yeah, those guys have always been stupid, that class of character. But normally, because they're dudes on screen, they get elevated more. But no, these guys are just idiots.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love guns.
I love this, just that tug of war of being like, we're not the goons who just hit people and come in. We're the, you know, sweet talking goons, and their fight and it kind of blowing up into this violent end. I think I had a better time than Alonzo, but I definitely had my problems, which means that it's a great time to vote.
Can we, before we vote, I want to know if we've talked ever into seeing this quickly.
Into streaming it.
Or if they're like, I'm going to
stream it.
Okay. Right. I love it. That's like we've never had such a clear vote before that actually had involvement in the choosing if you're going to screen it, stream it, or skip it.
Is Beanie gay?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. What about Margaret?
No.
No, then I'm not going to go fucking watch it in theaters.
Fair.
Fuck off.
Fair.
Are any of these people playing Butch Dykes, or are they both femme?
No, eat my ass. One's a Butch.
One's Butch. Okay.
Who is Butch in this movie?
Beatles. She's Butch adjacent. She's
soft femme. Okay.
Yeah.
In a cop uniform, you know, take it or leave it.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I should go support in the box office. I feel very torn as a queer person. I want to celebrate queer media and the pop culture zeitgeist, which is not queer.
There's an actual like queer cheerleading movie executive produced by Elliot Page that's opening in May. Like you could.
Save your ducats for that one. Yeah. Why? Dildos? Come on. Yeah.
They are saying they hope this is the first. They're planning to make two more of these, Alonzo.
Oh, are they?
Oh, are they?
Okay, well, in that case, Coens, Trisha. Put in a good word for me, will you?
All right.
My vote is I'm a skip it. I'm sorry. I wish I could be an ally to this movie. But, you know, yeah, is it a positive gay presentation? Yes. Is it a good one? Not really. I was gobsmacked at how much this movie wasn't working for me, and kudos to whoever edited the trailer, because that trailer had me excited for this film. I thought, oh, this is going to be funny, it's going to be queer, it's going to be all these things, and didn't like it. Sorry.
A makeout party?
Yes, for reals.
It's meant to be jokey. Like, we left it. We're like, nobody's had. And it's not. It's even called a basement party, as if that's a thing. Like, oh, we're having a more than once, people are like, oh, we're having a basement party. Like, that's a thing. It's
a thing that we all know that is. Mm. Yeah.
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 I'm between a stream it and a screen it. I had a lot of fun with this. I really, like, the absurdity spoke to me. I liked seeing people that age and those backgrounds, like, get to play these really ridiculous, outlandish characters. Like, I feel the scripts coming to younger actors, female actors, like, they're a whole lot of the same. And this was very fun. I didn't have the pacing elements that Alonzo did. I laughed a whole lot at this. Do I think it's as strong as both of the Coen brothers? No, but I'm happy Trisha Cook is out there. Maybe next time she can take the lead. But I thought it was a very fun view.
I'm right there with Drea between screen and because I had a good time, but like I said, I'm a slut for the Coen bros. You know, if you got any space in that second relationship, Ethan, let's see what's up, you know. But I had many problems, and I think, you know, we are in such a great era of like progressive media that when we're choosing to sidestep, I think, important aspects to like queer culture and black, like you know, these movies about blackness that try and sidestep like queerness, I will give it the same kind of knock. Like, I think we're at the point where we need to be intersectional in our media at all points. And you know, it's not going to happen at Tyler Perry Studios, but I am kind of really, you know, in the same breath, I want to say, you know, if you're talking about queerness, mate, and you have a person of color there, you have to intersect that people of color. And if you are talking about blackness and you have a queer person there, you need to intersect that. It adds a different element to that experience, and you have to respect it, because then when a person of color or a queer person watches it, it'll just stick out to them very clearly. But yeah, we'll be right back after you hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Welcome, everyone.
on.
Step right up. We're going to heal you. We are the healers, Ross and Carrie.
Yes, yes. You there. You look like you're upset. Come up here.
Yes, you are healed because you've listened to our podcast.
Yes.
Have you been having trouble with demons?
Are you sleeping too much? Too little? Just right?
We have the solution. It is to listen to Oh No, Ross and Carrie.
A show where we examine unusual claims.
We show up so you don't have to. Find us on MaximumFun.org.
We won't actually heal you.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm Yosef Uwadiway. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Ever Maynard.
Drea Clark.
We have an email from Stephanie who has requested a Baltimore accent.
Yep.
See, now we're getting... See, that's, I haven't seen The Wire, first off and foremost.
Do Divine and Pink Flamingos. You'll be fine.
Oh.
But have you seen The Europeans? No. The Henry James adaptation.
No.
That's classic 1800s Baltimore. That's the good stuff right there.
Oh, my gosh. No, I'm just going to say, what's the movie that you maybe unintentionally use as a litmus test for people interviewing to be in your life, hon? One of my favorite movies is 16 Candles, but if you couldn't recognize that it's highly problematic, we weren't going on any more dates. That's okay. This is an amazing question, and I got so many thoughts because... Like, I have follow up because, like, do you introduce that question? Because if I'm a dude and I'm like trying to, you know, romance you, I'm definitely not going to be like, this movie you picked, by the way, kind of sucks, just so you know. You know, I would feel like that guy who's trying to be like, I'm a male feminist and I just want you to know. Like you, so I'm just going to assume that you kind of initiated, but this is a great question. I'll let other people go, but I do have thoughts. Yeah, go.
I hope we all heard you say hun in there. So natural. Oh, yeah. Just hun. It just flowed like you call hun. Us all hun all the time.
Hun.
Listen, hun. This one's tricky, and I feel there's elements of this which we've discussed before, because on a surface level, it's important to me to not yuck anyone's yum. So if someone loves something unabashedly, I don't want to judge it outright per se, because I think it's great when people love things. But if I'm having a further conversation and you find out why, or you're like, oh, cool, so you stopped watching movies after you were 13. That's a huge part of my life, like not being able to talk about what movies are exploring or how they are part of the cultural landscape. Or like that, there's a lack of curiosity there. Or like, you know, we talked too about the people who are like, oh, I don't watch subtitled films. And that, I'm like, I will judge that. That's a litmus. But also, are you open to maybe starting to watch those, you know?
Yeah, no, that I think I probably used to have litmus tests with specific titles. Then I realized, you know, we've all got our own set of whatever. But yeah, the larger issues of like, if somebody tells me they don't like watching subtitle movies, they don't like watching black and white movies, they don't like watching movies that were made before they were born, all real things I have heard from people, I'm like... We can be friends, but I'm going to have to work on you. You know, it's like I'm going to you are now my project and I have to fix you because clearly you're broken.
I think it is cooked into I just want to give her credit or them credit, Stephanie, who wrote this, because they did say that one of their favorite movies is 16 Candles, but if you can't recognize this problematic, so there is a nuance to what they're asking. Right. I just want to say, I appreciate that part of any kind of litmus.
You can love that movie and also understand why it's got.
Yeah.
I think my litmus test varies year to year. I do have a telltale sign that a relationship is over. And it's every relationship, at least three major relationships have ended with watching 101 Dalmatians, the cartoon version. Oh. That's when I know it's fucking over.
Wait, do you want to watch it?
We've either watched it like right when we've broken up, the day before, or during. So when 101 Dalmatian, when Pongo comes running into the screen, he's got his little dogs in his mouth. I'm like, it's done. These drunk geese, all of it, it's done. The relationship is done. That's never. How I know a relationship is done.
Do you start 100... like popping it in now when you want out? Or
is, yeah, is right? It...
The universe like, the, is like,
the
here
common
you go.
Denominator is you.
It's me.
So what does that movie do to you?
I'm the one scheduling 101. Hey, why don't we watch this?
And you've already DeVille told them about how that's happened.
Yeah. Like, so is there sorry. Anything you want to talk about?
I'll say too, on the broader side, again, if someone has curiosity and wants to get into it, sure. But if someone like my two of my best friends in the whole world, absolute stoners, worst movie taste in the world, the amount of film, like they unabashedly love everything Kevin James has ever done. More than once, they're like, Paul Blart, have you seen it? I'm like, well, you've definitely asked me that before. And also, I'd never found it as funny as you did. But again, they just want to be sharing this terrible stuff with me. There's something endearing there.
Kevin James.
You guys, what I'm saying? I'm too wishy-washy to have litmus tests.
Kevin James.
Kevin James.
What's Kevin James doing these days? Does anybody know Kevin James?
I don't know, but I hope it involves a Segway and a mall.
Look, Paul Blart, that was a real moment, you know?
I love the fact that it's the McElroys and the Worst Idea of All Time podcast to do an annual Paul Blart podcast.
No.
And the idea is that, like, when they die, their children will take it over, and it's called Till Death Do Us Blart.
No, it's
no,
not.
No, no, no.
That's hilarious.
No.
Oh, man.
That's commitment.
You know, it's so funny. For one of my... like, as far as movies goes, one of mine used to be The Big Lebowski, naturally. Just to see if you like that. And The Big Lebowski has held an interesting comedic part of my life, because the first time I watched it was when I joined my first post high school improv group, and the team was like, you got to watch this to understand our kind of comedy. And, you know, in retrospect, no, I didn't. you know, but like it really did kind of get me sucked into like just those like rewatchable hits. And so that used to be mine, but I wouldn't necessarily be judging. But there was a period in like my last run of being single where like I would make people sit through a season of I Think You Should Leave in its entirety. And I would judge them based, because if it was too absurd, I'd be like, oh, you're gonna think I'm a weirdo, you don't want this, you don't want this, I'm gonna help you out, I'm gonna let you know there's gonna be a point where you're like, you're completely weird.
Why do I picture Iffy showing dates The Big Lebowski like Ken showing the Godfather to various Barbies?
it's wild, because like you never quite have seen I Think You Should Leave until you have this Nigerian man trying to put his head in your lap after the final episode of the season's credits roll. Like
I think you're that's gonna on the cover.
I say yeah, Netflix recommends.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm gonna pay you for your time.
Don't watch this without a Nigerian man to get in your lap. Yeah.
If you see me sit straight up, you know that you failed the test. Oh man.
Good question, Stephanie.
Yeah, that was a stellar question, and I thank you so much, Stephanie. And remember that you can leave us a message for the hotline by going to maximumfun.org/hotline or emailing us at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. But now it is time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
I'm super excited about a new Blu-ray that the folks at Altered Innocence put out of a film called Gay USA. It is a documentary from the 70s. It actually, people always talk about this, a landmark film called Word Is Out, that's often talked about as like the first major LGBTQ+ documentary. But Gay USA actually got into theaters a few months earlier, and it was shot at various pride parades in 1977 in New York, in LA, and several other cities. And this was right on the heels of Anita Bryant and the whole Dade County, you know, like stripping queer people of, you know, government of officially protected civil rights. And so there's this palpable sense of like urgency and anger, but also like people having a good time, and, you know, drag queens and you know, a real sense of joy that's permeating these occasions. And some of the people they talk to just have such amazing stories about their lives and how they got there and how they wound up in San Francisco or whatever. And it's really beautifully edited. And it's directed by Arthur Bresson Jr., who has this fascinating career because, like, he made documentaries. He made Buddies, which is considered to be the first, like, narrative movie about AIDS. But he also had a very successful pornography career. Tight. So just, you know, kind of covered all the bases. And this Gay USA Blu-ray is great. It comes with four short films of the period that also sort of deal with similar subject matter. There's a commentary track featuring the god of us all, Jenny Olsen. So yeah, it's just a really great Blu-ray. So I'm always recommending physical media in general, but specifically you should have this Gay USA Blu-ray in your library.
Get it in your library.
I'll go next. The irony always representing Alonzo holds down for physical media. So I recognize that I'm saying something that's just recently streaming. That said, please get out there and check it out. It is a documentary called I Didn't See You There. It actually won the Truer Than Fiction Emerging Filmmaker Award at the Spirit Awards last year. Filmmaker Reed Davenport is a disabled man with cerebral palsy. He goes through life in a wheelchair and is filming a lot of this POV of what it's like to experience the world his way. But he is also an incredible craftsman. He's got this beautiful artistic eye, and a circus tent goes up across the street from him. So he starts to analyze how people with disabilities have been treated through the world, and the sort of separation, the contempt or the condescension or anything else that's happening. Historically, people considered freaks, how he is seen. He narrates some of it, but a lot of it is unspoken and just some incredible imagery. It's really, really beautiful work. It is currently, it's just come out in like the last few weeks. It is on, you can rent or buy it on Apple TV or Amazon Prime or probably some other places, but I highly recommend checking it out. I Didn't See You There. Get behind it. Get Reed making more stuff. I can't wait to see what else he does.
Ooh, that sounds so.
Yes. You got any movies to
honestly, I was really inspired. So I got really into queer history during the pandemic and reading about it. And Alonzo brought up Gay USA. It's not a movie. I read a lot of Lillian Fetterman, but there's, I just picked up, it's over 1,000 pages. She's got a book called Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, which is about lesbians, but this is the gay revolution. It's about queer and gay people and the history of rights in this country and notable queers and benchmarks in this country. Some of it is good, some of it is positive, and some of it doesn't make any sense because here we are having gay pride parade in the 70s, but we're literally being killed in the 70s. So it's very complicated and sad and wonderful. But if you're going to read, if you're interested in queer history, I think Lillian Fetterman is a great place to start. Honestly, besides 101 Dalmatians, Old Yeller, sob yourself to sleep. Let it go. Let those wild boars tear up your heart and shoot that dog, baby. Let them know it's for the best. You got to let them go. Sorry, babe. Out the door. I got a trunk full of dildos and a dead head. Bye.
I want to believe that you did not watch Drive Away Dolls because it does not feature a dog.
Yeah.
You're like, I have one requirement for my motion picture consumption.
Did it?
And, yeah. Have a dog.
And to bring it back to queer history, Old Yeller stars Tommy Kirk. Gay actor.
Ah. All and right. I guess there is a dog.
What is the Dolls. Will Ferrell yeah. movie where he's a dog, but they do voiceover for dogs?
Strays.
Oh, Strays. Yeah.
Strays.
I recommend Strays. I've never seen it. Highly recommend it.
I sense a theme this week.
Yeah.
If he brings us home.
Mine, I'm going to keep it short and simple, you know, which, you know, I'm giving mine to promote a friend in a little indie flick that just came out. Make sure you go and see it. Some up-and-coming director, Villeneuve, yeah, Dune 2. Go see Dune 2, Villeneuve. Go see Dune 2 with my boy Timothy Chalamet. You know, they need the bucks. You know, who's keep cinema alive.
Yeah, definitely. No one will see it if you don't tell them to.
Exactly. You know, we need more movies that's not trying to focus on the dialogue. You
support
know, like
these
we
struggling
need,
indies.
Yeah, yeah. We need that. We need the movie that's focusing on the picture. thank you so much to Ever Maynard. Ever, good friend. If you have the chance, anytime they are doing a show near you, definitely go see them. They are so fucking funny. But
also,
I give the floor to you.
Ever came on having not watched the film because not your fault, like a communication mishap, but then followed that with a staff pick of a book initially. And that one too, I was like, I mean, who's not going to be like, oh, now I'm best friends with Ever Maynard, I guess.
It's a massive book.
You know,
this is a
dogs and cats living together.
Look, I'm your good friend. I love
you.
Too. It is your fault, Ever. You came on my movie podcast. You didn't watch the damn movie. But is there anything that you want to plug before we get out of here?
I gave my opinion on the movie. Yeah, I still get my opinion. If you're in LA, you can come see me March 7th. I'm running my solo hour at Nico's in Atwater. It's about my queer life, growing up in rural Texas, realizing that I'm non-binary, trans-leaning, coming out to my family over a trash fire. It's super fun. And then May 9th, I'm a part of the Netflix Is a Joke Festival. I have my solo show at UCB. So that's been really fun.
Woo, nice.
Listen to y'all gay pod. You know, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's very inappropriate. It's very explicit. We don't recommend. I mean, you know what? Listen to it at work. It is raunchy as hell. It's raunchy and
over the loudspeaker. Yeah. Put it on speaker.
Crank it.
Get a JBL jam specifically for the office.
JBL jam. The one with the light up thing around the speaker.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Whatever they use at the Spirit Awards, that's apparently the way to go.
All right. Andrea and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. Y'all are a dream. Always love doing things with you. And listeners, thank you for listening. You're lending us your ears for this short time every Friday or whenever you choose to listen to it. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org or find us on any of our social media channels, which are all linked in the show notes. And next week, we're going to be starting something new. This March is going to be Dune Month here at Maximum Film.
We're doing it.
And we're kicking things off next week with the one and only David Lynch adaptation of Dune with special guest Guy Branum. It's going to be spicy. It's so funny because I was just chilling with Atsuko. And Guy was talking to me about this Dune. So he was like, "You need to see this. You need to see it." And now
he
gets
into it on the Baron all the
yes.
time.
Yes. Oh
his
yeah.
Favorite things.
Oh man, I'm so excited for that, and you should be too. You should also be excited about our producer, who is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbar. Our senior producer, who is also wonderful, her name is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.